This is Radio Westenberg Fabrizio. Anytime you change something and you haven't accounted for all the variables, you just can't predict the consequences. Think about an ecosystem. When you remove one part, it can throw off the balance and the result can be devastating. Well, the same thing happened in China when, in the late 70s and early 80s, the communist government imposed this policy that restricted couples to just one child. Functionaries had done the math on increasing population numbers, and when they projected forward, they saw the potential for economic decline and famine. But what the filmmaker Nanfu Wang revealed in her documentary about the policy is that officials didn't include in their calculations the cultural dynamics, how baby boys are preferred to girls, or the emotional dynamics, how people are forced to choose between their conscience and their country. And the result was a staggering number of abandoned babies, forced abortions and sterilizations, not to mention the emotional trauma or the corruption that fed off a market created by so many displaced children. This isn't the first time Nanfu Wang has made a film that challenges the Chinese government. Her documentary, Hooligan Sparrow, is a profile of an activist there. Her documentary called One Child Nation premiered at Sundance last year. It's the latest in our series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening One Child Nation next week. Today in the program, Nanfu Wang is joining us to talk about it. She joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. You were talking to a colleague several years ago. Someone had asked you what you thought. This was a colleague of yours who had asked you what you thought about the one-child policy being relaxed in 2015. And one of the things you said was in response that it didn't actually affect your life, or you didn't think it actually had affected your life. And I wanted to start there with what you knew at that moment. Could we talk about that?
Absolutely. You know, I grew up, my whole life was under the one-child policy because the one-child policy started a few years before I was born. So ever since I remembered, the one-child policy was there and it was a part of my life. So it was complete something normal that you stopped questioning. And then by 2015, when the one-child policy ended, Christopher, who later became the producer of our film, he asked me, So as a Chinese person, what do you think of the policy? And I said, oh, yeah, of course, the policy, there was a lot of controversy. There were forced abortions, which I was familiar with because my mom and every woman in the village that I knew, they had to go through forced abortions and sterilizations. And I even remember when I grew up, the women in the village, they would talk about going to get a forced abortion or sterilization, as if they were going to the market to buy some vegetables. Like, it's so common. Somebody who and who would say, oh, they just come back from an abortion. They just come back from sterilization. And the words abortions and sterilizations, I've heard numerous times, and they stopped meaning anything to me. It just became this part of things that you don't ever question. And I said that it didn't affect my life because I joked that, well, my family was an exception because I had a younger brother. And although all my friends, people who I went to school with, they were all from a one-child family. But my family, because we live in the rural area and my parents didn't have official jobs, so they were considered farmers. And also for some of the reasons, for example, my brother and I are 5 years apart. Right. So we had to meet certain criteria in order to qualify for a second child. And when I do have a younger brother, I always consider myself an exception for the one-child policy, which I felt it didn't affect my life. And of course, like soon, half a year later, I would find myself saying that very naive.
One of the things you've said was that this process for you has been unlearning what you had been taught all of that time, that you had an idea growing up with that propaganda surrounding you everywhere, that you sort of had this settled idea about what this was about. And then I guess through this process of creating this film, you had to unlearn those kinds of things. Is that right?
Yes. It almost felt like a therapy session, but it's you are your own therapist. So you're constantly asking yourself, do you remember how you felt when you were a child and why you felt that way? Oh, yeah. And then after, you know, a lot of thinking and researching and talking to other people, I finally realized that that's why I felt that way. And I also noticed there were parts of, like, my knowledge. Like, I always believed that this is a universal truth. Or something that is, you know, it's like facts. Mm-hmm. But then soon as I did more research, I realized, oh, this is the source of my information, the source of my knowledge. As if, you know, like every part of your knowledge, if you trace back, you can find where it comes from.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about the policy itself. I want to get some of these particulars sort of on the record here. It begins around 1982. Explain, Nanfu, why does it begin? There's this crisis, this population crisis.
Mm-hmm. The official start, 1982 is when it's written in the Constitution, but the official start is actually several years before. 1979 is when they officially launched the policy. And then even before, in the 1960s and early 70s, they have talked about the one-child not as a policy, but as an idea, as a suggestion. And the reason was because several things. One is the leadership had ambition that China is going to surpass the Western capitalism in the next two decades. And in order to do that, we have very limited resources. So per person, per individual, we don't enjoy as much resources as, for example, an American individual would have.
Yeah.
So the solution would be reduce the total population, then the actual per person resource would be greater. And the other reason is also because China had just suffered from a huge starvation due to the Great Leap Forward. Mm-hmm. And there were many deaths, you know, caused by it. And the other justification is we couldn't feed as many people. And therefore, we need a population control policy to make sure that we can survive.
It's interesting. This is an element that comes up in the film a lot, Nanfu, is that people were truly traumatized by that experience of starvation during that era. And it played into these fears that they had about what the government was telling them about if you have more than one child, there will be starvation, there will be these terrible conditions, and they didn't want to be traumatized like that. So that was another one of those really complicated elements that they felt like, it seemed like traumatized from that experience too.
The fact, though, is a lot of people who have never experienced starvation or poverty adopted that narrative too. So a lot of people my age or a little bit older who personally had never seen starvation, they would also say, you know, how horrible it would be if we all starve, and if we didn't have the one-child policy, we would all starve to death. And for a long time, I didn't understand it until we looked at all the propaganda material.
Yeah.
Then it suddenly made sense to me because if we looked at the kindergarten textbook or children's book and all the way through college textbooks, they're in different forms telling you this theory. And I remember vividly there were a lot of cartoon, you know, drawings, illustrations for young kids, which on one page it would show a child would have an apple to himself. And on the next page, it would show like seven people fighting for one apple.
Yeah.
And then each one person got like a tiny little bite and everybody was unhappy. So I think from when we could remember things, we were educated this way. So the idea and the theory of starvation is not an actual threat to some extent, but it's a fear that generated by the authorities through education.
Yeah, you talk about growing up, you saw those reminders of that propaganda everywhere, matchbox and lunch boxes and billboards. You said it was everywhere. But then your mother mentions in the film that mm-hmm. there would have been cannibalism. You know, Nanfu, what are you thinking? Of course it was a good policy because children would have been mm-hmm. fighting in the streets and killing each other and eating each other. I mean, she really believed that.
Yeah, my mom believed a lot of things. It was very interesting because we, till this day, we still constantly argue. And I always try to point out, like, why do you think this? Do you know why you think this? And the cannibalism and everything, that's not unfamiliar to me either, because it is, like, in our books. It is in the promotion material saying that it's a possibility. And my mom recently also said something to me that really surprised me, that she said, you know, the violence is justified in China, the authority using violence against citizens because we Chinese are of low quality. We are people of low quality, that a lot of people are just not suitable, like, for democracy. And when she said this, I was very astonished. I said, Mom, why do you say so? And she said, yeah, like 80% of our population are peasants. They are uneducated. So therefore, they're not capable of civilization and democracy. And yeah. therefore, it's like needed violence. And at first, I was very shocked. But then more thinking led me to realize that those were word to word in my textbook too. When I grow up, is always say that the reality of our country is that we are a vast country, and 80% of our population are peasants, farmers, who are, a lot of them are illiterate.
Yeah.
So the basic rights is a survival instead of any human rights. So growing up, all of those were, I think if people don't try to question or unlearn it later in their lives, they would always just take it as the truth.
Let's talk about how this experience growing up, being surrounded by this one child policy propaganda, how that affected the way you reacted when you started to want to tell the story as a filmmaker, and then when you became pregnant and then had your son, because this seems to have really brought it all home for you. The baby was born prematurely, as you tell about in the film, your baby, your son. You were separated at first, and this was a really traumatic experience, and it seemed to really make you realize what it might be like to be separated from a child.
Absolutely. I noticed that the transformation, it's weird because I didn't expect it that I would have a lot of, like, perspective shift after I became pregnant. The one thing that I noticed in the week of knowing that I was pregnant, the week after, was I became very protective. I used to be a much more, I think, reckless person, but then as soon as I know that I was pregnant, I became much more cautious. And that sense of responsibility and protection made me very surprised, because I didn't know that it would be so effective. And so I started talking to my mom, and in our just a casual conversation, I asked her, so when you were pregnant with me, what was that like?
Mm-hmm.
Did you experience anything? What were you feeling? And what was that experience? And of course, she told me, oh, back then, you know, that was the one-child policy and a lot of things that she personally feared and things that she witnessed the women around her who had gone through. And I mean, those things my mom told me, some of the stories I was familiar, as I mentioned, because I grew up hearing stories of women going through forced abortion sterilizations. But what my mom told me again, with maybe more details, maybe because now my perception is different, they suddenly seem much more real and cruel to me and shocking. And for the first time, I felt I was listening to those stories as a woman, as a mother, and it felt unbelievable how anyone could live that life every day, constantly in fear, not knowing whether they can protect their own child, whether they can even make sure that the baby is born. So all of those things made me question what I knew before and what I didn't know. And I think that's what motivated me to find out more.
Tell the story that you express in the film of what must have been a sense of dread as well as anticipation for your mother when she becomes pregnant with your brother. I mean, this was, as you say, 5 years after you were born.
Yeah.
And she tells the story in the film. They weren't allowed to do gender tests. So
yeah.
She must have been just excited and also dreading it. It must have been a terrible experience in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. My parents, they were under a lot of pressure because my father is the eldest son of my grandparents. And at the time, he was the only son who has a child and is going to have a second child. And my grandson is a very traditional man, as you could later see in the film. He really favored boys and wanted to make sure that our family name would be carried on by a male offspring. So when my mom was pregnant with a second child, which he fought against the local authority to make sure that my mom could have another child.
Yeah.
And of course, when she was pregnant, there was a possibility that it's another girl. And in that case, a lot of people in rural areas, and I mean in cities too, which is less common, but it happened too, that what they would do is, as soon as the child is born and they realize it's a girl, they would either abandon her or just in any way they could get rid of the child.
Yeah.
So they were hoping that they could, tell the authority or try to fake it that there was no child and there's no registration. And then they can have an opportunity of trying again the next time and hoping that would be a son. So on the day of the delivery, my mom was in labor, and the midwife came to our home, and my mom is in the bedroom. And as they were waiting for the child to be born, my grandma put a basket in front of my mom's bedroom, and my grandma said, if it's a girl, she's going to put the infant in the basket and get rid of her. And of course, luckily, my brother was born, and then there was a celebration.
Why no gender tests? Why didn't they allow them to do that?
Because the government knew that because of the one-child policy, a lot of families, if they only were given one chance, then all of them would have wanted to have a boy, or most of them, 90% of them. And gender tests would create much severe problems of, which already happened, like a girl abandonment, and also the gender imbalance, which still is a problem. But if they allowed the gender test, it would be much more severe.
Nanfu Wong, she co-directed the film One Child Nation with Xiaoling Zhang. We're going to be screening the film next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
On the latest episode of Preach, what happens when your dad, who also happens to be your priest, says it is not your destiny to play football.
I was looking at him like, come on, man.
Like, you didn't feel like God was saying it to you?
No, of course not, man. I was staring my dad in the face. How could this not be for me is what I'm thinking. Y'all tell me follow my dreams. I can't follow my dreams and not play football.
Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about China's one-child policy. Next week, we'll be screening Nanfu Wang's documentary about this 36-year social experiment, which made it illegal for Chinese couples to have more than one child. The film explores the devastating consequences of the policy. It's called One Child Nation. We'll give you some details about the screening a little bit later on the program. I wanted to ask you about what it was like when you returned home, when you returned to China to take your son, to see your family. Of course, your first film was somewhat critical of the government, and so I'm just wondering what was it like in practical terms to be able to get back into the country? I'm sure you wondered if you'd ever be able to go back. And I'm sure you wondered if you did go, how much you'd be watched, how much you'd be followed, whether you could even bring a camera. I mean, what was that all like?
Yeah, because of the first film, there were a lot of uncertainties on whether I would be able to go back and what would happen if I did try. And when I started this film, a lot of this were unknown, and the biggest fear is if I show up in China and started making the film, if they actually did allow me to go in, then as soon as I pull out of the camera, the government people showed up, which is completely likely, and that would just jeopardize the entire filmmaking. We would, the film would be over before it even started. And then when my son was born, by the time he was 4 months old, and my family also really, really wanted to meet him, so I thought it would be a great opportunity to test the water to see how the government would react to me going back to China. And so my husband and I took our infant son back to China, and we also tried to observe what would happen. And the strategy was if the government ever questioned me why I was back, then I could say visiting family and look at this infant. And so I wasn't doing any filming. But it's a way of testing because that had been 2 years after I had made my first film to see if they still cared enough to surveil or interrogate me. And there wasn't any confrontation, or at least the government didn't show any signs of harassment. And then I came back to the U.S., and then I thought, now it probably is fine for me to go back again. So I went back one more trip just by myself to film. And then, ironically, they soon actually invited me to go back to China officially to show my second film. And that was when I thought, okay, now I can go back officially and I could take more opportunities to film. And then I kept going back until we finished One Child Nation.
Yeah. Let's talk about, I think one of the most powerful parts of the film is just the people that we meet along the way and their personal stories. And I wanted to tease out a couple of them here. I wanted to ask you about Huaru Wan, and I'm sure I've butchered the pronunciation on that name.
No, she's, you did really well. I'm really impressed.
Oh, good. Okay. She's a midwife, and you go and visit her and talk to her, and her story is extraordinary. Let's start with the part where you ask her how many babies she delivered, because she didn't really answer that part. What she told you was how many abortions and forced sterilizations she had done.
I went to see her one night, and I didn't know what exactly she would tell me. I went in and I thought, I'm just going to start with a warm-up, easy question. Like, how many babies did you deliver? And I thought, for a midwife like her, who is 84 years old and who has delivered babies all her life, that would be something that she would be really proud to answer. And to my surprise, she said, no, I don't remember. I never kept tracking how many babies I delivered, but I did count how many babies I aborted. And then she said that is 50,000 to 60,000 abortions that I had performed. And then she continued by saying that she counted those because she felt guilty.
Yeah.
And of course, all of these things were completely surprising to me at that moment, sitting there and listening. And of course, the surprises just kept going, and she talked more and more. I think that moment was a very crucial moment to me as well, because before, when I thought about this movie, I envisioned it to be, you know, two sides. There are victims, there are perpetrators. And for people like her who performed abortions and forced women to sterilize, those I consider they are perpetrators. At the moment when I met her and saw how traumatized and how tormented she was, just like any other victims, the women victims that I had met. And so it was that moment I realized that she too is a victim of the policy, and everyone else is a victim of this policy. There is no such villain when people are doing things because they were taking orders, because they were told that that was the right thing to do for the country, for the universe.
What's powerful about Juarez Juan's telling of all of this is that she doesn't really excuse what she did because it was part of a policy from this intolerant regime. She fully accepts that she may be, that yes, maybe she was following orders, but that she carried them out, she says. I mean, she takes responsibility for that. And that's sad to me in some ways. I mean, I guess it's, I thought it powerful that she wasn't just saying, oh, it was a policy. There was nothing much I could do. She felt like that in some ways, as she puts it, the universe, what goes around comes around, and that she was going to be punished for this by the universe in some way.
Yeah, I think that is respectful. And in contrast to the other people, the official, the male village chief, and another female official, she definitely had shown a lot of much more remorse than the others. And I think I empathize a lot with her because of that.
Yeah. She says she's atoning for her sins. And so she stopped almost 30 years ago, retired basically. And now she told you she only works on infertility issues with couples. And there's this really lovely moment in the film I wanted to ask you about where these couples, once they have a baby, they send her a flag. And her house is packed with these flags. And it's a lovely kind of sort of visual image of these parents who are happy and grateful. And it must be something that helps her deal with all of those bad memories.
Yeah, but I agree. On the other hand, I was also thinking, it's almost like, you know, it is heartwarming to see that. Everybody praised her as a good doctor. And on the flag, they put a picture of the newborn baby that she helped and on it. But on the other hand, it's like so chilling because she thought that every baby she helped bring into this world can counter like 10 or 100 babies that she killed in the past. So in a way, you know, these flags and these pictures are reminding her every day how many she has done in the past. And they are almost like a visual, you know, it's like a graveyard in a way, that walking into that room and see wall after wall of like dozens of these flags and baby pictures is reminding her how many she has killed before.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, there's a contrasting story that is told by Shukin Jian. She's another family planning official, and she doesn't feel regret. She doesn't feel the same kind of remorse. She talks in an absolutely chilling way about chasing some pregnant women and having these forced late-term abortions, these forced sterilizations. She talks about aborting babies at 8 and 9 months, chasing these women, as I said. But she puts the national interest before her personal feelings. Talk about this part of the film.
She is much more, exposed and high profile than the village midwife. This is a person who, in every year China selected the 10 best family planning officials, and she, in many years in a row, is one of the 10 best out of the entire country. So that says something. Like, the level of indoctrination that she received is much more than the village midwife that we talked about before. And she is a party member. She felt devoted to the country. And she's motivated, I think, a lot by her performance, by evaluation from the higher level than any ideology or personal morality. So that's why I think whenever she felt contradicted, whenever she felt dilemma, which she did, she struggled a lot. She mentioned that for many times that she thought this is an atrocity and she wanted to quit. But then there is another voice or somebody higher up told her, no, you are a Communist Party member and you have to embrace the challenge. And all you are doing is great for the national interest. And then she gradually believed so.
Yeah.
And I think it's completely indoctrinated to the point that she lost her original sense of right and wrong and the morality.
Yeah.
And that's why I think she does not have as much regret as the other midwife does. And she is celebrated. She felt good about what she did, and she received a praise and reward for that. And I think it's hard for someone to reflect when the whole country and people who you admire tell you what you do is great.
Yeah. One of the things that comes up that she tells you, this woman, is that she says it was like fighting a war for your country. And in this sense, we were fighting a population war. And that was another important part of the propaganda, wasn't it? That this idea of a population war was a common slogan, and that just got drummed into the way people were talking in those days.
Yeah, I think war is another example, and this is not limited in China, it's all around the world.
Yeah.
When any government justifies killings and deaths and things that a person who normally would never do or would never bring themselves to do, once it's justified as war, as protecting the country, as something greater good, then they became capable. And in China, the one China policy, one of the slogans, of course, is we are fighting a war. And of course, there will be people dying, and those deaths are inevitable and necessary for the rest of the people. And that's what this official was talking about.
Yeah. Wanted to ask you about another part of the film where you feature the work of an artist named Peng Wang. We see some of his work. Talk a little bit about why you wanted to include this in this story, and talk about what drives his work, because that seems to be the question of how it is that people could, how these young nurses would be willing, for example, to chase down pregnant women and force them to be sterilized or abort their 8 or 9 month old fetuses.
Yeah, so this artist, he encountered the one-child policy by chance. He was painting landscape, and then he usually went to the trash sites. And one day he found some abandoned fetuses and almost like full-term babies abandoned in the trash sites. And the more trash sites he went to, he saw more of those. And the more he saw, the more questions he had. And then he started investigating more. And then he, in the early years, discovered, you know, a lot of the true reality of the one-child policy. And he started shifted all his entire career to just preserving the evidences of the one-child policy. And he, of course, is highly controversial, and he had received a lot of retaliation from the authority because of the work. And I had known him a long time ago through his work, because it's so controversial. There were very few people who does that, and is very visual too. So, for example, one of his artwork was to preserve those real babies into a jar and to keep them, you know, in the same form, and which we filmed. I mean, ever since I knew that existed, it wasn't a question whether this would be included in the film. It was always something that I wanted to have in the film, because I think that is the object evidence. We're talking about testimony. We're talking about interviews and people. But that is something that I think is harder this to see as a graphic. It's difficult to watch, but that is how reality is. It's a true representation of what the reality is. And how could we censor it in a way to beautify the situation by not allowing people to see how cruel it was?
Peng Wang said to you that the most tragic thing is for a nation to have no memory. And he's worried that this country, that China, that country will just get rid of this memory. Now that the policy is passed, it's not talked about in the same kind of way, that people will forget it. What does he mean that it's tragic to have no memory?
You know, a lot of things are censored in China. The information is very strictly controlled. For people like me, my generation, a lot of them have never heard of the Tiananmen Square protest. A lot of them have very little knowledge about a Cultural Revolution. We don't learn this the kind of things in the history book, and there is no information available online. All the things that if you Google, I mean, Google doesn't exist in China. If you use the Chinese equivalent of Google, the results are all filtered. So I knew that I know very little about those things until like I left, and then was exposed to more information, and a lot of people, younger people, know even less. And the one-child policy is one of those examples that by the time that the one-child policy was over, suddenly you are seeing how the government is writing its history on this chapter. There were extensive reports on how much contribution the one-child policy had on our country. There were all things, all the media coverage was positive, and the things that were negative were completely gone. And not long from now, I think even for some of the material that we could find, they would not exist anymore. So we felt the urgency to document the part of history that actually is what we lived through, and we share that sentiment, the artist said, to preserve the memory.
I want to ask you about a truly terrible story that your mother relates in the film. And it just made me think about just how prevalent this was in all families must have had these same kinds of experiences all around the country, of course. But your mother tells about helping her brother abandon a baby girl at a meat market. And the baby being just left there for, I think it was 2 days and two nights, and eventually it died. Would you just talk a little bit about that story and about your mother telling it? Because it's a really, I don't know, it seems like this unspeakable, horrible thing.
Yeah. When my mom told me, I was shocked. And then I wanted to talk to my uncle himself because, I don't know, just like I think I said a little bit in the interview too, as a mother, I could never imagine myself abandoned or see any harm done to my own child.
Yeah.
And him as a father, how could he do that? And I think that interview with him was really difficult because my uncle was a person that I was close to, but he was always like an authority figure to me and a little intimidating. So for many times I attempted asking him to sit down with me and talk about it, but every time I couldn't bring myself to ask, to request that interview, because I knew that he had never spoken about this since it happened, and I knew how painful it could be for him. And I also felt, I was afraid of a rejection. I was afraid of him not saying yes and or being offended by the request of interview.
Yeah.
So it didn't happen until like several times. And I was like, damn, I would do it next time. I would do it next time. Until it's really like, I was like, okay, if I don't do it now, I would probably never have a chance. So, because I only have limited time in China every time. So eventually I did. And then I think, like, you can see from that interview how painful it was for him. It's on his face. But one thing, though, I think he said in the interview made me understand why he did that. Because he said his mom, my grandma, threatened to kill herself.
Yeah.
My grandma said, if you keep this infant girl, then you are choosing between her and me. And if you keep her, I would strangle her and then kill myself. My uncle said it in a way, and based on my understanding of my grandma, I could see that's something that she would do. And then that made me understand what kind of a pressure that is that pushes my uncle to eventually left his own daughter die outside.
Yeah. Your aunt has an equally terrible story in the film, giving an infant daughter to a human trafficker. She mentions how she didn't think about the girl's future, only that she was that the baby would be able to live. It gave you a sense of just how desperate they could be and how sad it was. And then this brings us to the idea of you know, selling babies, trafficking babies, and it's an important part of the film. And it brings us to Utah, it brings us to Lehigh, Utah. That's an important, there's a couple there, Brian and Longlan Stai, who live in Lehigh. Brian's wife is Chinese, Longlan. Talk a little bit about the Utah element. How did you find them?
Yeah, it just happened to be there. I mean, serendipity. All three of my films have some kind of elements in Utah. yeah, it's complete coincidence. Brian and Longline live in Utah, and we found them through research, and we read articles about them and knew that they run this organization, Research China, and they adopted three Chinese girls themselves before they started any research and any DNA match. And of course, as adoptive parents, they were very curious about where their daughters are from, their stories. So initially, they were just trying to find more information about their own children. And then one time, you know, by talking to people in China, they realized that some of the information that they received from the government, from the orphanage, were fabricated. And that motivated them to find more. And the more they looked, the more inconsistencies that they found. And eventually right now they are doing, they've established a very thorough database, and they've done so much research in China that they are helping a lot of families connecting their birth parents, you know, adoptive families with the birth families.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Nanfu, about one word that comes up a lot, and that's choice. Time and time again, people would say, look, it was a policy. We had no choice. We had no choice. And that is a really fraught word in the United States, of course, when you're talking about the idea of reproductive rights and abortion rights. Mm-hmm. And the question of abortion, that comes up as well. I mean, it's clearly there as a sort of an element clearly in this film. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because you've said choice is an important part of this film.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one thing that I, after I came to the United States, and I learned that in certain states that there were restrictions towards abortions. And to be honest, I was very, very surprised. I am a person who believes in reproductive rights, and the choice should belong to the women themselves. Mm. And when I came to the United States and knew the reality of here, and it was different from what I would think what freedom looks like. And when I was making the movie about the one-child policy, of course, on the surface, a lot of people would see that as a so-called anti-abortion theme because of just so much of how much in the film we criticized about the practice in China. But then I think that's really deceptive, because there is a fundamental difference between state-forced abortions and women's choosing abortions.
Right.
And I think these are complete different cases. And to the opposite, the state-forced abortions and states' limited access to abortions, the two, you know, in written sounds like the opposite, but they are, to me, very, very similar. Both are government and authority trying to exert control over women's body, women's choice. And I wanted that message to be clear.
What are the consequences now, the larger consequences? It's one thing the film refers to, not enough young people to care for the elderly now. Now the signs have changed. The propaganda is different. They're saying have two. It's so interesting the way this has turned, this story.
Yeah, it's ironic because there are a lot of problems that are results of the one-child policy, and some of them are lack of labor, workforce, lack of elderly care. And, of course, because of the lack of labor, the economy is not going to be sustainable. And because of lack of elderly care, the government is feeling all the burden. There's not enough Social Security. So the government is really encouraging people to have more children. But ironically, because of 30 years of promotion that one child is the best for you all, people now who are at the age of getting married and have children, they lived their entire life thinking one child is the best, and they don't want to have more than one child.
Yeah.
So no matter how the government is encouraging people, the birth rate is not increasing, it's decreasing. So there is a lot of, different levels of governments trying to come up with incentives to make people to have more children. And a lot of the propaganda method, the songs, the performances, and the slogans, they were just the same as the one-child policy's slogans, and they just replaced the one with the word two.
Well, Nanfu Wang, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Nanfu Wang, She co-directed the film One Child Nation with Xiaoling Zhang. Zhang is going to join us for a Q&A following the screening. That's next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.